Hey everyone, did you know that there is a video version of this podcast episode? We now have a YouTube channel where a video version of each podcast is uploaded with visuals. We recommend checking out the video format as the visual references will make it much easier to follow along. We also have on our YouTube channel other content such as battle reports, which are not available in this podcast format. You can find the link to our YouTube channel in the description of this podcast, or just search Into the West Podcast on YouTube. Welcome to Into the West, a Middle Earth SVG podcast. My name is Charles. Joining me today are Richard, Ian, and a special guest, Alisher. Today, our discussion will be centered around a question: can a player do well at a tournament with any army in the game or the majority of the armies of the game?
So guys, just letting you know that you don't have to take a Legendary Legion to play competitive. I guess a question for all of you is, what do you think makes a list viable for competitive play?
But how is it for you guys? Like, do you guys have a concise, like, when you go to make a list, you have like a list of checkboxes that you're going through?
Well, definitely, like, this goes into the conversation of like whether you're playing like a niche, what we say, like skewed list, or like a well-rounded list. Obviously, like a well-rounded list is a little bit easier to build, but I personally find that one of the easiest indicators to making like a list like viable is just at least having one warrior profile that is of decent value, like per points. I find it very, very hard to build a competitive list when, you know, you don't have any access to like maybe like a warrior profile that isn't a good bang for the buck.
I'm trying to think back. So obviously I have had the pleasure of being at tournaments with both of you guys, at least Charles and Richard. My mind immediately goes back to this past Nova. Richard, you had a really, like, just an eclectic amalgamation of various things, right? So in that list, what would you say was that warrior profile? Because as I recall, it was a lot of goblins and black Numenoreans? Or no, am I?
Yeah, like a Moria contingent with the Watcher in the Water. I had a Mordor contingent with some black Numenoreans and some orcs, which I actually think orcs are pretty decent value as well. But then most of all, I think I was also getting very good value heroes. So I think in that way, you can substitute a little bit of that into the equation. Like, I had the Spider Queen. The Spider Queen is really great value. Personally, I think Malthasaran is one of the most underrated heroes. So I guess just finding the profiles that are quite efficient.
Okay. Yeah, none of that makes sense.
Sometimes it can work in your favor if it's not like the most popular army at the time, because people might not prepare for it. For example, I brought Assault upon Helm's Deep to Nova, and I think it was still pretty popular at the time. And so there was a lot of Blinding Light, and there was a lot of things that could counter my list. And I didn't end up doing well because of that. And so perhaps if I brought a list that's not seen as competitive, I wouldn't be up against so many things that I'm weak against.
I guess then there's another two ways you could look at it. There's trying to chase the meta, which is kind of what like you were doing, Charles, like a little bit. And then there's just taking stuff that you want to and whatever, and who cares, which is kind of like, you know, the other way. And then if it's off the meta, but it could end up countering them, like things that are in there pretty well with, and nobody realizes it because it just isn't taken that often. Right.
Or just taking something that like directly counters the meta. Obviously, like, we were quite surprised, like, arriving at Nova and seeing how many AOLs there were. If we had known that information, then you could potentially build an army that counters that a little bit, you know, like what we talked about on our AOL episode, like, you know, bring either like chariots or bring like magic, fight four, you know, stuff like that. And I mean, it would have worked well because both Charles and I played two Assault on Lothlorien Legions. So
I have to say, post-COVID SBG is very different from like my experience than pre-COVID SBG. I think like competitive desire, at least in my area, has really gone through the roof. So it really changed the dynamic. I know for me, when I make lists, I try to have a few like boxes that I'm trying to check. I like to try to make sure that I'm covering some of my bases. But honestly, at least in my own experience, now I've at times kind of chased the meta. I've kind of, I guess, laxed back from the meta. I tend to perform my best when I just take something that I'm not really thinking too much about. Now, that doesn't mean I don't spend a good amount of time trying to optimize the list for what it is. But I remember, the COVID era was really interesting because I had, leading up to the COVID era, I had been competitive. Like, I started trying a little bit too hard, and I had a number of real just tournaments that went south for me. And then COVID happened. I don't remember how long of a period of time I didn't get to play, maybe a year. And then the first tournament that I came back to, I had left the state for a while and then came back. I took Return of the King. I had never played Return of the King. Someone actually had to bring it for me because the timeline was really weird. I ended up winning the tournament. It was a 3-game tournament, mind you, but it was just like, not having that, I guess, the fixation on that meta really ended up helping. And the same thing happened with the Nova stand-in, actually. I had submitted my list. The organizer of the tournament had published everyone's factions after everyone submitted their list. And I remember sitting there saying, like, there were Corsairs, which my list wasn't going to play well against in my mind. And then there were 3 or 4 Angmar lists, which I really didn't want to play against. And honestly, I ended up playing against 2 of the Angmar lists. And what came down to it was, despite all of my fretting about all the little things that they were going to do against me, it just, intuition in the game really determined the dynamic of how that game went. And in the end, I beat both Angmar players that I played against. So I was really curious to see how that went.
Yeah, I think it's been harped on a lot that like MESBG is like one of those games where like I think skill comes before anything else. I think a lot of beginner players focus a lot on list building, which is nice. I think it can give you an edge for sure. But I think there definitely is a wide variety of lists that you can win with. And I'm a supporter of definitely playing something that you have fun with. I know a lot of players like give me crap about like all these like crazy alliances and all that. But it's because I have fun with it, not because I'm trying to be cheesy.
You know, I've had the opportunity to play an array of things. I think the army faction that I like to play in terms of enjoyment the most, that I think I don't typically see in the top 3 placings too often, is Khazad Dûm. So that's an event, an army I've had tournament success with that I don't see too often.
Okay, so let's jump into Alisher. You brought your Khazad Dûm list, actually, that you've done very well. Did you win the tournament with this list? Maybe share the list with us and then let us know how it plays or what's your general strategy with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the list was 750 points. I had Durin as my general, the King's Champion, and then a captain, which had a shield. I had 10 Hearthguard in Durin's Warband, along with 3 Vault Wardens, 2 Dwarves with Shield. In the Champion's Warband, obviously the 2 Heralds, 1 Vault Warden team, 2 Rangers throwing axe and bow, 6 Dwarves with a shield. And then in the Captain's Warband, it was 3 Rangers bow, 4 Dwarves shield. So it was 40 models overall. My breakpoint was 21. I had 7 Might and 5 Bows.
That's a lot of Vault Wardens. Too many, but like more than you'd expect.
This was an event. It was a grand tournament in Tennessee, and I had not played the Dwarves leading up to that. But Dwarves were my first army that I ever got into the game with. So I wanted to kind of change it up, something a little bit low key that I wasn't too worried about. And of course, I do research. My mindset as a player is, regardless of what I play, it's competitive. Like, that's my mindset going in. And at the time, now, COVID kind of really twisted everything, but one of the UK players that was actually performing the best, I think, of anyone at the time, was playing just pure Khazad Dûm. And I was really, really perplexed by that. In his mind, as I kind of talked to him a little bit about it, and he was talking about it, he thought the Vault Wardens were really where it was at. And now I looked at his list. He did something like 12 Vault Warden teams, like a ton of them in his lists. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that, because the way the Vault Wardens work, they're great, but you have to play them the right way. If you get kind of swarmed in the back, it's just a bad day. So I wanted to try them out, but I didn't want to lean into them too as heavily as he did, because I knew I didn't have the skill to do it.
In my mind, I feel like Vault Wardens probably excel when there's a lot more terrain on the board, right? Because you want to kind of fill those gaps and plug those holes. And because of their like movement, same as every other dwarf, is it the case that if it's like more of an open field battle that, you know, they're not really doing as much? I find that if you're just doing like a standard battle line with them and they're just like D9 with spears, like nothing special, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's really, it's terrain dependent, but it's also opponent dependent. So at that tournament, it was 5 games. I think I did 4 major wins and I did a minor loss. The minor loss was against Goblin Town and it was a really open board. And that was exactly what you're saying. So in that situation, there was not a lot of terrain for me to castle around. It was capture and control. So it was really that spacing kind of mattered. So he was able to swarm around me and get to the objectives. The game ended before he could get too many of them. I forget what the score was, but it was a minor loss. And that it really worked that way. The first game I played, though, was against Azog's Legion, and the board was still fairly open. But dwarves have like they can spread out enough, and if they can play efficiently enough, they can kind of create their own like wall of defense. You got to play them in such a way that capitalizes on it, but you can kind of spread out in a way that other armies can't because they want to have. I don't know. Have you guys played the Khazad-dûm dwarves or played against them at all?
So Alex, who used to be a regular on the podcast, he has a Khazad-dûm army. So yeah, we've all played against it a fair number of times, but he doesn't run any wardens.
Okay. See, what I find so interesting about the Khazad-dûm, and it's part of the reason why I'm drawn to the list in general, is it like some of the lit army, like the way the army works is that some of it kind of plays counterintuitive to how the rest of it plays. So like in this list, you know, the 10 Hearthguard obviously are going to do some damage if they can win fights. They're wounding just about everything on 4s. And then the entire army's rerolling 1s, which as I've played the list is critical to its success. I don't ally into the dwarves because of that. The bonus is just so good. So you have these Hearthguard that are phenomenal. You have the Vault Wardens, which are really good as well. I mean, they're strength 4. They wound monsters really well. But then you have these regular strength 3 dwarves with shields and then the rangers. What kind of lets me have longer lines than is traditionally, I almost exclusively use the shield dwarves just to shield. All they're supposed to do is hold the line and win the fight. And because I have 2 banners in the list, I just think about it in terms of weight of dice. So I have fight 4. I'm tying or winning fights in most cases. If I have the banner and I'm shielding with them, I have 3 dice that I'm going to have to win that fight. So just statistically, if I win the fight and I back off, they're fine. They're alive. They're still sitting there. If I lose the fight, they still need 6s to kill me for just about everything. That's going to be hard for them to do. And then the Hearthguard and the Vault Wardens are kind of just kind of sprinkled out a little bit here and there, and they're just plowing through things. And then the heroes just plow through things as well.
Okay, so one thing that caught my eye with this list, why the captain with the shield? It might be like our group meta kind of thing, but in general, I think we see a lot more Dwarf Kings. I think the general consensus is just, again, when it comes to value, I think, you know, the fight 6, the Dwarf King's a hero of valor, right? So why the captain? We don't personally see that profile a lot.
Yeah, I end up playing the captain quite a bit. And, you know, it's twofold. First of all, it's a fight 5 hero, defense 8 with shield. So we can shield. So again, 4 dice, 5 dice with a banner. So it can just hold things down pretty well. In terms of choosing the captain instead of the Dwarf King, I've played both models independently and in the list together. At the end of the day, it's 10 points cheaper. And that really, like, it affords the extra little upgrades and it affords the extra body, which really, like, for me, I like numbers is one of the boxes that I like to check. I figured that I already had 2 fight 6 heroes in the list. So in a third one that couldn't strike wasn't necessarily too much of an asset to me. And so I was more interested in having like the couple throwing axes, and I was more interested in having the ability to really just throw him into an enemy hero, be defense 8, throw 4 dice, 5 dice with a banner to just win the fight and then not worry about it.
This is sort of the elephant in the room, but your thoughts on Durin? Personally, you know, in the past, we haven't really given him a very good score. And I personally see him as being quite an overcosted hero, but it seems like Hearthguard is part of your main strategy. So that's probably my guess, like, would be the main reason you're taking him.
Yeah, so it's interesting with Khazad-dûm, because I played two variations. I played this variation, and then I played the variation that I prefer, which is completely different. And I actually don't take it to too many tournaments, because I really want to figure out how to play it as effectively as possible before I do so. Because at whatever point I start playing them, I want to play them a lot, and make sure I know them. So in this list at 750 points, I honestly, like, it's so interesting because I get a lot of flack in my group because of this. I really enjoy unmounted heroes, and I specifically enjoy unmounted heroes that wound things well, like an Aragorn on foot or a Durin. And the reason why that is because the mobility, once you're in combat, is just unparalleled. I can throw Durin into two models with spear support, so four models in a fight. I know I have five dice to win if I have the banner, because he has three. I get the Durin reroll and I get the banner, so I'm going to win that fight likely from a statistical perspective. And then I'm wounding just about anything on fours or threes, and then I'm rerolling ones to do that. So the consistency of being in a position where A, I can throw him in, I'm not worried about him, I know he's going to kill, but B, if I put him in a bad situation, his base is so small to where everything else around him gives him natural protection. I've played a lot of variations with heroes. I honestly, as much as people are so horse heavy, and this is my own group, so I'm not saying, you know, the breaking news of Alistair is not saying unmounted heroes are the meta. That's not what I'm saying at all. This is an only Alistair like theory here. I really like the mobility of unmounted heroes.
That's really interesting. I mean, we got a friend in Australia that thinks very similar too, so you're not alone.
Yeah, there are a couple people who are really, I remember like the other dwarf guy. Like, I try to follow as many of the forums as I can. So I remember following him talking about Iron Hills, and he had started with Army of Thor and Khazad-dûm and then tried Iron Hills. And he was like, I just can't with this boar. I just can't figure out how to do it. And I thought about it, and I'm like, you know, like, as much as there are, especially in the case of Dane, so many advantages to having that boar and having a mount, there are also just these little, like, disadvantages that you don't have to worry about on foot that a lot of people don't consider. But to answer your question about Durin, so in this type of a list, in my opinion, a very standard list, I like Durin in the list. I think Durin just operates magnificently. I will say in Khazad-dûm, the Warhorn, and I know this from the list that I played more, the Warhorn means everything, because at the end of the day, courage for dwarves on paper are good, but in practicality are a pain. And I'll kind of, not to digress, but I'll quantify that by saying the list that I play now that I personally think is the most competitive way to play Khazad-dûm is Iron Guard and Ranger Heavy. It prioritizes the heroes a whole lot less. So at 650 points, and I play around with this a lot, the list that I've been playing is it's the King's Champion, a Dwarf King, a Dwarf Captain. The King and the Captain both have throwing axes. It's 12 dwarves with shield, 10 Iron Guard, and 10 rangers with bow and throwing axe. So the big keys of that, 37 models at 650, which I like quite a bit. And then you have 22 throwing axes. I don't know if you guys have played throwing axe dwarves. That changes how dwarves play a lot, because now all of a sudden, a movement 5 army has a lot more potential damage capacity with their movement. I can move 5 and then still have a 6-inch range of attack on top of that. So a lot of the shenanigans that people play with being right outside of the range of the dwarves, they can't have that. And the rangers specifically, because they hit on 3s naturally, they hit on 4s, which is better, the equivalent to any other throwing axe model in the game or throwing weapon equivalent.
Yeah, that's a very interesting list. I'd be curious to see how that goes. Yeah, I think when we're talking about this list in particular, I do really like certain aspects of it. Personally, yeah, I think I'm just not as sold with Durin, but I think you've built a really like well-rounded list. I like the model count, and there's some really, really good threats here. And I think we brought this up in the advanced armies or hardest to play armies. Khazad-dûm, I think a lot of beginners are drawn towards this army because, you know, it is one of the coolest dwarf factions, but yeah, it's extremely hard to play. So, yeah, I think going into the ratings, I personally think that Alisher is just, you're such a good player that you're going to be able to win with a lot of armies. Kind of like, you know, what we talked about in the intro here. I think it does come down to player skill more than the list a lot of the times. I think this is a solid list, but, you know, with Durin, I think he's dragging down the list a little bit here. So probably a Hero of Valor from me.
I wasn't sure if we were doing ratings for this video, but I don't want to repeat too much of what Richard said, but this is not like a list that I would play if I was playing Khazad-dûm. I think personally I would go a Dwarf King or maybe even two and just get my numbers maybe up to close to 50s. This looks like a really complex army to play, and the fact that you won a tournament with it, it shows more than anything like you as a player. Personally, I don't believe in Durin, but maybe I just need to bring it to a few gaming days or something. But I have to give it a Hero of Fortitude because I just think that profile handicaps your list, at least for my playstyle. So
in Durin's defense, I don't think any of us three actually own a Durin. I think it's just because we've played Durins and it's just, you know, we just kill him way too often that I think maybe we're underrating him, but yeah.
Okay, I have Durin and have played him, but obviously not to that success. Otherwise, I would be coming to Durin's defense as well.
Well, I think that my play style in general, I'm very specific with how I play my heroes, and they usually don't die. And it might just be a difference of list. I don't think I've ever lost a dwarf hero when I play Khazad-dûm. I'm trying to think to the times that I played it in this edition. But like, I've been playing Lake Town a lot right now. I think I've played, I don't know, 30 games at least. And I think the majority of them are tournament games. I think Bard has died once in a practice game and Gandalf has died once in a practice game. I hear people talk about their heroes dying quite a bit and all of a sudden the model goes. My play style is very hero protective and I'm really specific about what risk I throw them in.
All right, then I'll wait until you beat me with your Khazad-dûm and then I'll bump this list up to a legend. Okay. I'm sure you could do it.
I don't know. I'm doing my classic thing where I'm torn between a Valor and a Fortitude. I think I'm still leaning towards Fortitude, but like there are still like a lot of stuff that I do like in the list. Like, well, mainly like the numbers. I'm always surprised about the numbers that Khazad-dûm can put out, considering like we said earlier, like they're usually all high defense models and they're all fight four. So that many models is really good. Yeah, I think I'm still at a Fortitude, but I'd be willing to change my mind if proven otherwise.
Ian has also brought a list to share with us today. And Ian, why don't you go over your list and just the strategy, because you've also brought this to a tournament. So maybe go over like what the experience was like playing it.
Yeah, so I finally brought my Dol Guldur list to a proper event. This is a few weeks ago, back in February, when two of us went down to Portland and a couple others from our group. So anyway, I guess I'll just kick it off with the main man himself. So I have the Necromancer. He has 5 Gundabads with shield, 5 Gundabads with spear and shield, 1 Gundabad with spear, shield, and banner, 200 orcs with two-handed weapons, and 200 orcs with bow. Then I have the Witch King with 500 orcs, 200 orcs with two-handed weapons, and 200 orcs with bows. A 100 orc captain with a two-handed weapon, so he's just on foot. 4 Hunter Orcs, 4 Gundabad Warriors with Spear and Shield, and 2 Hunter Orcs with Bow. And my last warband is the Lingering Shadow, and he has 2 Hunter Orcs with Bow. So that's 800 points, 40 models, 10 might, and 8 bows. The basic premise of this is I just throw a lot of Strength 4 attacks at the opponent. To keep it simple, the Hunter Orc profile is kind of ridiculous. 2 attacks at Strength 4 is like the equivalent of most captains. And I have 22 of them. So just that profile, if you can get them into one-on-one fights against most other warrior troops in the game, they have a good chance of winning and killing just because of number of attacks and high strength. As for the Necromancer, he's not amazing. He can be, what I have learned is he can be a fairly reliable spellcaster because he has such a large stack of will in reserve and he the army bonus where you get a free one when you cast. Basically, every turn, you're going to throw four or maybe five dice at a spell. So you're going to be getting that spell off at high values. So it actually makes him a pretty competitive spellcaster. The problem with that is that you need his spells to be doing something pretty much every turn. Like, you need to be like either like immobilizing or chipping off a wound or at least burning your opponent's resources. Because if he's not doing that, it's just a huge point sink. And you're not going to get the value out of it. That being said, I think... Okay, Immobilize was pretty useful for me during this event, but so was Chill Soul. Like, I think those may have only been the two spells that I casted the whole event. Chill Soul is not subtle, but being able to throw a wound onto just anything in the movement phase is actually incredibly useful. You can snipe banners with it. You can snipe a key troop out of a spot to, like, free up some guys who've been tagged. There's just so many options with it. It's a great spell. Now, I do have... a few two-handed weapons in this list. And when I originally was playing with this, I didn't have them at all, and I thought there was, like, no point in taking them. And then I played a few games, and I realized, like, I just couldn't kill heroes because I don't have anything that can do damage to heroes that are, like, defense 7. Volume of attacks only gets you so far if you can't roll sixes. A hunter orc with a two-handed pick that pierces strikes wounds defense 7 on fours, and if they're trapped, he's rolling four dice. That's a lot of damage. So just having the few in there was great. It's the same reason I gave the Hunter or Captain the two-handed weapon. He can put out a lot of damage as well if I need him to. And comboing him with either the Witch King or Lingering Shadow to strike up, it's a pretty good combo.
All right, Alisher, go ahead and trash him. The man gave you a fortitude.
No, I had to quickly pull up the Necromancer's profile to see what his spells were, and I had to figure out the Lingering Shadow. So I've played against some variations of this, not with the Necromancer. I'm a big fan of spellcasters in general. 250 points obviously is a lot to sink in. You obviously are getting the benefit with your two wraiths. They're doing a lot. So I'm interested, like, from your perspective, Ian, did you feel like you could spend the might on the Witch King in the Lingering, or did you feel like you were saving that up for if they rolled poorly on the Resurrect rolls?
I try to keep at least one might point on them as long as I could, just into the late game in case I needed them to Resurrect. But, you know, there still are only 75-point heroes, so if I didn't need the might point to strike up, I was fine spending it on them if I needed to heroic move or something like that. But the other thing about having a spellcaster sitting behind your lines, they don't need their might for a whole lot of things. So the Necromancer, like, again, I'd still try to keep his might, at least one of them, just in case I needed to boost a combat roll or something. But I'm totally fine spending his points of might for a heroic move. Same thing with, like, the Hunter or Captain. Like, he's not going to do a whole lot else with it. So, yeah, I try to keep it on the Lingering, but it's nobody's might is super, super important. Because, you know, like, I'm not relying on my heroes to go and do the big, like, big hitting and do a lot of hero comments. They're just there to try and, like, you know, eventually maybe strike up against a hero with the race. That's it. And then call moves as I need it.
I can really only ask questions because I don't know what it's like to play it. Did you feel like 40 models was, like, a low model count? Now, obviously, you have the attacks to compensate, but I know how it was like playing Army of Lake Town models and then having a bunch of allied contingents to have low model count with the Army of Lake Town models, and then D4 just not holding up.
So, 40 is like the minimum that I would play it at. So I did playtest another version of this list where I had a Gundabad captain instead of the Hunter or captain from Azog's Legion. I had a couple of Gundabads in there, and it was 36 models, I think. It just didn't do as well. So even just like the four model difference, I found like it did end up making a big difference because I need the models to be able to fight in a line. Like I can make a wide line because I only have so many spears, but I need to have models still behind to cover those gaps when those models do die. Because again, the Necromancer cannot get pinned. If he gets pinned, then it's just like it slows down my game a lot.
And you don't have a Warhorn in this list, is that right?
I do not. The Gundabads, they're D6 and they're also Courage 3, which honestly in this list made a huge difference. Like, comparing the hunter orcs and their ability to actually like pass courage tests to the Gundabads is like no contest. Like the Gundabads are just, it's a huge difference. The hunter orcs objectively are probably better than the Gundabads, but I'm still happy to bring as many as I did because the courage 3 was actually really important in actually was really important in most of my games that I played.
No, I mean, I love the Gundabads in the list, honestly, because especially you have 10 of them, no, 9 of them with spear, and then you have the rest with just shield. Like, I think a list like this, I remember back to when Rhaenyra was here and Rhaenyra was playing competitively regularly, and he played Corsairs. And obviously, Corsairs have a lot of tools, but Corsairs are really low defense, and he would use Black Numenoreans in a similar, not quite identical way as you were using them here. And I remember, I know that a lot of the guys who played Rangers of Ithilien back when they were really popular always had a bunch of Gondorians, even though it reduced their bows, simply for A, the defense, but also in Rhaenyra's sense, for him, the courage. The Gondorians doesn't really matter, but in their case, just the defense. I love them in the list.
Question about just how you split the warbands. Did you ever consider taking the Hunter War Captain from Azog's Hunters so that you could get the army bonus in there on your bows?
So yeah, I think I did when I initially wrote the list, and then in the later versions when I ended up making this one, I kind of forgot about it, honestly. But in order to do that, I'd have to, because the Hunter Orcs, they get 50% bows, so I could put 6 of my Hunter Orcs there with the bows, but then I'd have to put at least 10 Hunter Orcs into his warband, and that kind of like messed with the structure of the warbands that I wanted. So that was part of the influence, but honestly, I kind of just forgot.
Unbelievable, Ian. You're demoted from Bowmaster.
So if I were to change the list, maybe I would only take 6 bows, but have them like that. But, you know, the deadline for list submission was coming up, and I kind of ran out of time.
I actually played this list on top table in the final round. Ian did really well with this list, and I actually thought that it was pretty impressive because before the Necromancer Legion came out, the only time I've seen the profile was with all the Wraiths in like an all-hero list. And then after the Legion, with all the Legion buffs, I'm guessing that's probably still the case. And so 250 points for one spell a turn. It takes the knowledge and the skill of just picking your right moments and the right targets every turn. And I find that probably the most challenging thing about the profile, because what, you could be taking 2 Wraiths with those points?
Honestly, like I said earlier, it kept it simple. Chill Soul and Immobilize were like my best friends for like the whole event. But, and again, it just goes back to the, like the reliability of the casting, like getting it, you every time you cast it, it's always on a 5 or a 6. And when you're doing that against even the biggest heroes, they burn through their resources really fast. And when I also have like the threat of the Nazgul who can kind of like jump in there and strike up, I found that big enemy heroes were quite willing to spend might points to boost their resistance rolls, which I was totally fine with because then it just gives me more control later on in the game.
Yeah, I really like this list. I mean, Lingering Shadow is probably one of the coolest wraiths. I think it has a lot of potential there. I like the profiles that aren't just like, oh, it has good stats or it has like burly, you know, it can actually have some utility. But I think similar to Alisher's list, I think just the main leader profile is kind of drags it down. And I guess it shows like how, you know, you two are very like skilled players and are able to like make the best out of these lists. But there's a reason that the Necromancer is not played that much. So yeah, Fortitude for me.
I'll go with the same rating. What about you, Alisher?
That's tough. I honestly would almost go with the Valor, and my justification for my defense for that is I really like, I had to quickly look at the spells, to be fair. Just the efficiency of the Necromancer is actually quite notable. I also like, I think what, the Necromancer's fight 7 or fight 8. I can't imagine you threw him in combat, but I like the fact that you have a hero where, you know, you can throw him into a combat late game and just automatically, effectively have the higher fight. I like the dynamic. I don't think he's the greatest hero imaginable for 250 points, but I don't think he's the worst. I like him in this list.
So Yeah, that's actually an interesting point. Most of the time in most of my games, he does end up in combat at some point, usually, like you said, towards the end of the game, to exploit that fight seven and the fact that he does have that instant kill. So, yeah, ideally you try and set it up in the late game where he can get a heroic combat off into an enemy hero, or just at least threaten that, so then they're burning resources as well to try and like strike up so they don't get attacked. He can also be an offhand tank. I never luckily didn't have to have him fill that role, but he's still D8 and he can have a ton of fate points. So not the greatest idea because he's your general, but you can do it.
All right. Thanks for sharing your list. So just to bring the conversation back to the beginning, do you guys think that the game is at a place in terms of balance where a player could do well in a tournament with the majority of armies?
Assuming all players have equal skill at this event and it doesn't matter like what armies,
or if you had the skill, is there potential to do well with the majority of armies?
Yeah, I think so. Also assuming you get enough time to learn the army, right? Because a lot of them do have different play styles. Sometimes it just comes down to like player skill, but if you have a certain play style that you're like really skilled at, trying to force that style onto another army that doesn't necessarily play that well, it doesn't always work. So, yes, but also no.
I think in general, I would say most armies, with the exception of, you know, several of the really, really terrible ones and or like the more narrative ones, I think you can definitely learn to be competitive with most armies. Maybe it's only at a particular points level, but I think it's for the most part doable.
For example, I wouldn't run the Necromancer at lower than 800 points.
My perspective will forever be changed after this past Nova. I mean, the list that won Nova just was entirely random. I still don't know quite how it worked the way it worked, just a bunch of half-trolls and some camels. And I see this a lot in the Philly group because I see a lot of people change up their lists. There is a real competitiveness to changing your lists constantly. And it just boils down to if you play the same thing over and over again, people are going to know how to play against it. And if you change what you're playing, you develop a competitiveness in that it's almost more forgiving because if you make a mistake, your opponent doesn't necessarily know how to capitalize on it. I know that from a personal experience of playing competitive lists. So like right now I play Lake Town a lot. It's actually easier for me to get into a bad situation and then suffer from the consequences of that bad situation with Lake Town than it would have been with a Doran list, or it was with a Return of the King list or a Moria list. Like, kind of as I was saying with the Moria list that I played against, and I was worried about the other competitive players, what they had. Like, what was my big fear in that was that they had Sap Will and they could remove my fearlessness from my shaman simply because the two player, and one of them was Evan Iverson, so competitive player, right? Simply because in that moment he didn't know what he was playing against, he neglected to Sap Will early on. And in both of the Angmar, one of them was Jacob Hall, just neglected to Sap Will on that shaman completely changed the game, won both games because they did not sap my shaman. So I think when you change lists, there's a competitiveness to doing so.
I think that's a good note to end off on.
Thanks, Alistair, for coming on the podcast to talk to us today. And for bringing your list to share. Thank you to all our viewers for watching, and look forward to the next episode of Into the West podcast.